Good day, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of The Numbers Don't Lie, where we put the numbers behind the electioneering back into the rightful place, front and center. I'm your host, Scott Peter Smith, and we are joined again by our resident data analyst and director of EDGIS, Paul Berkowitz. And for the first time on this series, Ranjini Moonsamy, associate editor of analysis at the TESO Black Star Group. Welcome, guys.
Thanks for having me.
Today, we're taking a closer look at gender and the possible gender divide in South African politics and the voting trends of women and their decision-making in this regard. So while South African Party often congratulates itself in representation of women in Parliament and our constitutionally enshrined right to equality, South Africa's gender divide is still clearly profound. In other words, the representation in Parliament doesn't always translate into improved conditions for women. But before I put my foot in it and we could get into some stats, maybe Paul, if you could just take us through some numbers behind women voters and their trends in South Africa.
Thanks, Scott. So the first thing to say, which is what we say all the time, is that because there's an absence of exit polls and rich survey information that breaks down the electorate into component groups, you know, not just who votes for which party, but how party votes are stratified by race and gender and income. We don't have a lot of that, so we can only guess. But what we do have from past elections, and we've spoken about this before, is that women as a group overall are much more likely to be registered to vote, and then they're much more likely on the day to turn out to vote. The big numbers we looked at in 2014 in the last national provincial election is that although women make up about 51-52% of the over 18s, the people who could vote, that number increases to 55% of all registered voters, and then again rises to 57% of all the people that actually voted in the 2014 national provincial elections, meaning that about 6 in 10 voters were women. But there seems to be a disconnect between women's issues and voting. Women turn out to vote, even though, as you said, a lot of issues which are important to women aren't being addressed. Unemployment figures for women, particularly black African women and rural women, are the worst in the country. There are longstanding issues of gender-based violence, intimate partner violence, and, you know, committing resources within the criminal justice system, within the health system to address that. There are health-related issues. We still, although there's been a lot of improvement, we've got one of the worst infant mortality rates and mothers dying in childbirth rates compared to developed countries. We're doing well compared to developing countries, but with our resources we could do a lot more.
But Ranjini, how does this women's vote actually make any changes in who's actually in power? What's the influence there? I mean, if they're not changing their vote based on all these other issues, what are they doing or what can they do?
So firstly, Scott, I don't think there is such a thing as a woman's vote because nobody talks to women as a constituency. So in other parts of the world, we've seen this where there is a specific target at women as a constituency. And you've seen it, for example, in Hillary Clinton's campaign in the U.S. elections, in presidential elections in 2016. So issues like health care and family planning, child care, were major issues on which she campaigned. But even there in the U.S., although there was such, you know, for example, in the Democratic Party, these were major issues, she didn't kind of win over the constituency altogether, because I think the final results show that a large proportion of white women, for example, voted for Donald Trump, irrespective of their rights. So I think that's a good, although, you know, it's by no means representative of trends among women voters around the world, it's an interesting test case that there was messaging directed at women, but there was almost like a rebellion from white women voters against the establishment, and a preference for something out of the ordinary and something way out of the ordinary. And we must bear in mind that just before the vote, the Trump was exposed for, the famous Access Hollywood tape, disparaging remarks about women. And you would think that would offend women and would not vote in the way that they eventually voted. But I think that provides for us a lesson in terms of not taking the woman's vote for granted. So that women won't vote because you are speaking at specific issues. We vote based on a whole compendium of issues and how politics affects our lives. Mm. But we must remember that a large proportion of our population in South Africa is largely conservative. So to shift voting patterns is a major thing. And to shift voting patterns amongst older women in South Africa, I think, would do a lot of taking. I think that's the massive problem with this particular election campaign that we're in now, is that you haven't seen specific messaging or specific campaigning targeting women with the aim of shifting voting patterns.
So here's an interesting thing. There was a report last year, the Center for Social Development in Africa, the CSDA, about October last year. It's a new organization for me. I wasn't aware of it, but they released some polling stats last year.
That's right.
So women are, of course, in generally, like most, especially in African countries, they do carry the bulk of socioeconomic and inequality burdens. So here's a question for you, okay? And I don't... I actually, for some reason, it just freaks me out, this issue. I don't know why it's not a clear win for any political party that's trying to speak to a woman issue, and that's sanitary pads. Why are not sanitary pads just thrown everywhere around the country to solve a huge problem? I mean, surely that's a win for a party. If you're going to get any messaging right, or if you want to attract a woman voter, surely that's a key issue or an obvious issue.
You might think so. I think, Scott, that Ranjini's touched on something very important.
Sorry, that was a curveball I threw at you, but it just kind of popped into my head.
Oh, okay. Well, to answer that a little bit, I'd like to unpack a little what Ranjini spoke about, because I think she's put her finger on it. Mm. Because we're complex, we have constructed identities. As Ranjini said, Hillary targeted so-called women's issues. But one of the biggest issues, which on one level you would think is a women's issue front and center, but it becomes, because it's about bodily autonomy, I'm talking about reproductive rights and abortion and Roe versus Wade, which has, it seems that it's seeped into all the issues, depending on how it's reported, at least in the United States. Talk about Donald Trump appointing more conservative judges to the U.S. Supreme Court who might overturn Roe versus Wade, or even more conservative judges on the district circuit. And I'm just thinking, here in studio, you've got an observant Jew and you've got a practicing Catholic. And it might have been that Hillary could have talked until she was blue in the face about issues which are important to women. But that a lot of women, not just women, but a lot of women that voted Republican, and we've seen this in other places, even, let's say, women who are African-American, who are poor, who are affected by all of these socioeconomic issues and these gendered issues and gendered issues around rights, maybe first and foremost are good religious women for whom it could be reduced to a single issue. Does this candidate support abortion, or is this candidate pro-life? Which just goes to show that, sometimes different parts of our identity trump other parts of our identity, and maybe talking about the women's vote as a big monolithic vote is as stupid as talking about the black vote in a country where 80% of the people are black African. It's just that, as I say again, we have such poor and such thin polling data, we don't manage to break down the entire voting population into small enough groups to handle.
But to answer the question on the sanitary pads, I don't think it's been made a political issue, and so people don't perceive this as being something to use their vote to secure. But there are other things that are, for example, with social grants. That is a massive tool that is used in campaigning. But I think that what this campaign has done is has opened up a number of issues. So, for example, with land, with housing, with job opportunities. But the language and the messaging around all these issues is targeted broadly. Mm-hmm. So when you talk land, you're addressing the unemployed and the landless, which are men and women. So although women bear the brunt of these issues and of the economic situation, there is not tailored messaging to women, to, for example, rural women who are struggling to eke out a living. With social grants, for example, that when there was the danger of an interruption of the SASA grant system a few years ago, when the Constitutional Court had to intervene, had that crisis escalated and had there been an interruption, we'd have had a massive human catastrophe on our hands that would have affected mostly women, I would say, sort of people who look after extended families, who have to look after, grandchildren, who bear the brunt of the migrant worker system. But yet, even then, there was no messaging targeted at elderly women, and that would have been the opportunity to do it, to say, this particular political party put your livelihood in danger. Mm. We are the ones who can secure it. But then you don't see that kind of politicking happening that would impact. So what it boils down to, Scott, is the psyche of the women voter, what appeals to women and what doesn't. Now, I think a massive flaw in the election campaign also, and amongst all of us when we debate this issue, is the assumption that women voters are elderly women in rural areas, because we have a large cohort, by far the highest cohort of registered voters are younger women, and these are aspirant young women who are seeking higher education opportunities, who are seeking employment, who are seeking upward mobility, and there specifically is the lack of targeted messaging, because there's nothing that any single political party is saying that targets this up and coming cohort in society.
No, exactly. I mean, even when you're talking about the grants and the pads, I kind of put that into the same basket. But it comes down to the messaging. So, speaking in terms of how political parties are speaking to women, there was a analysis done by the Mail and Guardian recently in terms of how many times the word woman was mentioned in the manifestos of the top groups. The manifesto showed that the word woman was mentioned 131 times in comparison with development, public, and land, which each mentioned more than 160 times by all the political parties combined. We're talking about the ANC, the DA, and the EFF. The IFP and the newly formed Good Party had actually the highest. They had about 1.1% in terms of the mentions of women in their manifestos. When we're in a situation where the DA draws almost two-thirds of its votes from women, as do the smaller parties at 65%. The EFF is the lowest in that regard. And in terms of implementing gender quotes within their parties, I mean, the DA is actually the lowest. But I mean, it leads to your question in terms of where's the messaging there? Then, I mean, if women have, there's almost 2 million more registered women voters than men, of somewhat?
Something like that, something like 14 to 12 million or something.
So, I mean, it kind of raises the question, where's the messaging? And,
I've got a theory, and it's not just my theory, because it's obviously developed by people who are smarter and do behavioral psychology better. But here's a universal truth about people, and it's not just women, is that people are more motivated and people are more able to understand and process mentally a negative thing than a positive thing. People are more risk averse. People are more worried about losing what they have than gaining what they don't have. And I think maybe that's the major difference between talking about sanitary pads or talking about social grants, because the very same research we've been discussing from the Center for Social Development in Africa, one of the first questions it asked the respondents was, do you care more about political rights and democracy, or do you care more about socioeconomic rights? The majority or a plurality of people chose socioeconomic rights above democratic rights, meaning implying they'd be more likely to vote for a party that would guarantee a job or at least maintaining the grant than they were worried about civil liberties. The other thing is, when the respondents in the survey were stratified according to whether they were grant recipients or not, that was another question. There was a small, it was weak, but it was statistically significant, it was there, that suggested that grant recipients were more likely to vote for the ANC. Not because of what the ANC had done for them in the past, not, you know, and that's the positive angle, but because of the fear that voting for another party might lead to a loss of that grant. And that is the whole rational risk aversion thing. So it might be that positive messaging, oh, you know, what we can do for you. If you vote for us, we could give you a job, we could do that, we could do that. It could be that the voters are a bit doubtful, or it might be that it's harder for potential voters to conceptualize a possible future rather than it is for them to a possible, more positive future where things that aren't currently there might be there, but it's a lot easier for them to picture a world where the things they have are taken away. And maybe that's where the opposition parties are missing a trick. Maybe instead of promising the moon and job creation, they should be spending more time reassuring ANC voters that if you vote for us, the social grants are secure.
Well, this is the reason I made the point about that the grant system was actually under threat under the ANC government.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't a vague possibility. It was actually, there was going to be an interruption if the Constitutional Court didn't intervene. But you see, I think you answer something about, you know, that people feel secure in things as it is, as opposed to as it could be, because there's always the danger of that change might bring insecurity. But you know, when you look at the issue of gender violence, and I think that we tend to also be myopic in the way this issue is dealt with, in that people don't see it as a political issue. They see it as a reason to protest, and that it's a massive crisis in our society, but it's not used as a political weapon.
Yes.
In that he's saying, as women, the vast majority of us are susceptible to abuse, have been victims of abuse, and that our children are in danger of being abused, but we don't use that to empower us as a lobbying mechanism in politics. So rather we check out of the political system.
Yes.
And have you seen protest action by women on women's issues, but not as a political issue? But you've seen protests at the union buildings, or to force the president into making statements, or to convene summits on gender equality and on gender violence. But you don't see it translated in the election campaign.
And maybe it feeds back into that point that maybe it's seen as such a big societal issue that no one party can affect it positively or negatively one way or the other. It's something that we have to solve, but it's not something that we could believe this politician's promises if they say they'll solve it or not. I don't know.
But I think what should have been, because we don't see the political parties responding to this issue. They're non-responsive on the issue unless there is militants and activism on it. So what should have been done the approach could have been that women say, which political party amongst the 42 parties has the strongest voice and the best plan in tackling gender violence and gender equality. And we haven't done that. And I think that that is prejudicial to us as women, because we're not using the power of numbers that we have.
Speaking of which, Paul, I mean, we didn't actually get into the numbers in our intro too much in terms of like where exactly the, in terms of the registration, in terms of where the woman voter is in their turnout, and what's the historical context there? Because I mean, we know that the evidence is that while women, yes, they have higher registration, they're less partisan. So in the sense that when I'm asking the questions in terms of like political parties missing the trick, it's like kind of leveraging off that less partisan approach or less party loyalty that the numbers show within the women constituency. How can they leverage off that?
The international evidence, you're right, Scott, suggests that women vote more, or they're more likely to vote based on the issues than on personalities, which might be in direct contradistinction to what Ranjani was talking about earlier. Maybe a majority of white women voted for Trump despite his personality. Or it could reinforce it. Maybe they were voting because they are socially conservative and religious, and they thought that a Republican candidate would be most likely to defend, to be more pro-life and to be more aligned with those issues than they were. And sometimes one issue trumps all the other issues. In South Africa, women, as we said, they registered higher numbers, they turn out at higher numbers. In terms of party loyalty, the same research we looked at showed that that there is a downside to disregarding women, that when the first round of this poll was done in 2017, there was a gap, there was a gender gap amongst ANC voters, or likely ANC voters, where many more men were expected or said that they would vote for the ANC, and women were likely to vote for the ANC in much smaller numbers. They reran this survey again, this poll again, earlier, well, I think in October last year.
Yeah, it was.
And that gap had disappeared. And the working theory there by the authors and the researchers of the survey was that Ramaphosa had managed to undo all the harm of the Zuma years. You know, that there was
it's a strong statement coming from the Berkowitz corner there.
I'm echoing other research reports and other news articles on this research report. Again, we don't have the kind of information that we'd like to have. If there were more regular questions in the polls that we're seeing at the moment, rather than just who are you likely to vote for, or I think the Institute for Race Relations has gone one further and has broken down the participants by race, but we haven't broken it down by gender or by sex to look at these things more closely.
Well, just in closing, I was going to bring that up. So in the sense that both of you in this recording have often referred to a lot of things happening in America, the way that things work in the States. So it kind of raises the question, I mean, where we are in South Africa in terms of our polling. I know you've mentioned before exit polling doesn't exist in this country. So we can't really make really good determinations in this particular election and how women are really going to influence things. We don't actually really know. I mean, we know they're higher registered. That's a simple demographic tick to have in terms of your data around elections. But beyond that, you know, representation in parliament is one thing. Women leaders in parties is another thing. But I mean, in terms of the vote, I mean, we don't really have the information in terms of whether they do influence things or not.
I think there are lots of gaps in our knowledge about understanding our electorate and understanding different types of voters. So there are lots of assumptions made about a lot of people. So with the youth vote, with the women vote, the rural vote, there are all sorts of assumptions made. Minority vote, for example. And I think that there needs to be more investment in terms of understanding the psychology of people in this country. So another thing that I feel is a missing piece is that we don't know whether women trust other women in politics. because our politics is very, very male dominated. Although I think the contingent, the ANC contingent in Parliament, the caucus, is split quite equally, you know, on a 50-50 basis of representation, and you know, even in the ANC NEC. But that doesn't translate. You find that there's a presence of women, but not leadership by women. And you saw with, for example, Nkosi Sana Dlamini Zuma's bid for the ANC presidency in 2017, that there was a massive trust deficit in her because people believed that she was, you know, almost a front for the Zuma camp. So which would have meant that somebody like her, who's an established politician, who's been, you know, was in the first government of Nelson Mandela, whose credentials shouldn't be really called into question, but somebody like her was still not trusted. And we have to look at those factors as to why people didn't trust. So, for example, you had Lindiwe Sisulu, who was on the Ramaphosa slate. So there was this massive push from the ANC Women's League to support Nkosi Sana Dlamini Zuma, but not to support her for the position of deputy president. The ANC, I suppose, is a difficult test case to use because it's 5,000 delegates who, and it's by no means representative of the people of South Africa. So I think there needs to be more sort of research done in terms of the broad population and how people feel about women leadership and whether this will be a factor in future elections.
Paul, any comments there? I mean, are you feeling a little bit out of loop since you don't have the data available to really answer the questions you're raising in this recording?
That's never stopped me before, Scott. But in all seriousness, not sounding too much like a fanboy, I can echo a lot of what Ranjini has said. And also, if I want to make reference again to Najak, as she's done, it seems to me that the whole business was done under a huge cloud of cynicism. And maybe it wasn't so much about Nkosi Dlamini Zuma having the first name Nkosi Sana, but the fact that the surname was Dlamini Zuma, which was more of an issue. But the cynicism comes in when you look at the internal politics at NASRIC. As Ranjini said, support Dlamini Zuma, but don't support Sisulu. Or say that a vote for, if you're the Women's League, say that a vote for Dlamini Zuma is a vote for women and a vote for emancipation. There is some earlier research to support this general era of cynicism, unfortunately. There was, I think it was done about 10, 12 years ago, where women in South Africa were polled and they were hopeful and they were enthusiastic about the gender parity legislation that had come in. Because now I think we're in the top 10, maybe the top 5 countries in the world when it comes to representativity of women at the highest political office. But if you asked anybody if they're voting for the ANC because they instituted the Department of Women, Children and People with Disabilities, maybe I'm projecting. Ranjan, you can corroborate or you can tell me I'm wrong. But I think you'd get a few hollow laughs and a kind of like, yeah, okay, well now we've got 150 million rand a year departmental budget for what's a box-ticking exercise. And nothing has really changed in the lives of women. I don't know if we're being cynical. Maybe, Ranjini, you could say, because you're the only woman in the booth at the moment, to focus so much on whether there's this big connection between women's issues and the way women vote. The international evidence, not just the US, but what we looked at in India and Brazil as well, which are maybe closer to our own experience, is that there's a lot of articles written around election time and a lot of discussion like we're having now about what will the women vote do and should politicians make overtures to women. And then the election comes and goes and the feeling seems to pass. You know, women could decide the election, but women don't vote en bloc. So treating women as one monolithic voting bloc is a form of sexism itself, right?
Yeah, I think so. That, you know, the women in all categories of society, and all of them have different needs and different perspectives, and look for different things in politics. So it's wrong to assume that you can have a one size fits all kind of party that will represent women's rights and views. And I think that's another anomaly in the political field right now, is that you have many religious based parties, and they speak to women, because by and large more women attend are members of churches and religious organizations. You have parties for landless people, and I think the ballot, if you look down the list, all those parties should have specific messaging that will target the people in the constituency that they're looking at, but nobody does. There's kind of blanket messaging. And that is why I think so many people are opting to vote for the least objectionable party in this election, because I think we're all struggling to find a political party that represents who we are and what we aspire to be. So I think whether it's women or youth or, just the average person, an average journalist, is that that's the struggle with this election, is that parties are not talking to us. And we have to compromise to find something identifiable in a party rather than the party identifying with who we are.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point to end on. If anything we take out of this discussion is it's a bit of what the women vote is and what it means, and especially what numbers we have available to us from a data perspective. It's still wide in the open. Hopefully that'll prove in the future. Guys, thanks for Ranjani and Paul for taking time out of your schedules to join us today. You've been listening to The Numbers Don't Lie, and you can find us on your podcast app, or you can find us on timeslive.co.za. Thanks for listening. Cheers.
You've been listening to Final Take, a multimedia live production from the Tiso Blackstock Group, publishers of the Sunday Times, Business Day, and Financial Mail.